If there's anything you want, just ask for it, old sports. Welcome to the Great Gatsby Week here on We Read the Book. I'm Adam Heap.
I'm Lois Mitchell.
And we're joined today by a returning friend of the show, Megan Griffin. Welcome back.
Thank you for having me again.
So our question of the week this week is going to be nice and easy. It's just a gender recast. So the Great Gatsby, a very famous character played here by Leonardo DiCaprio, you now have to cast the Great Gatsby as a female. So who do you get? Lois, you first.
She's a little bit older than I think possibly is right, but Kate Blanchett.
Yeah, that's a good call.
But if I have to choose someone that's more age appropriate, I'd maybe go with Emily Blunt.
Oh yeah,
I like that.
Yeah, I really like that.
Yeah, there's a lot of like ways you can approach this. I like it.
I think Kate Blanchett has the look that I would associate with Gatsby, and I would like love to see her in like a linen suit. I think she'd look really, really awesome. Like that. So I think she'd look better in like the time period. Yeah, she's obviously a bit older. So yeah, I think Emily Blunt would be good, because if you've seen any of the promo stuff for Mary Poppins, I think a similar air for Gatsby would be good.
Yeah, cool. Megan, what about you?
I went with Jessica Brown Finley. She's the youngest sister in Downton Abbey. She's also in an episode of Black Mirror that I really love. She's been in a few other things too, but she's around the right age, and I think can really pull off the like really nervous kind of innocent vibe that Gatsby has for like the first half of the book. And I'd really, really like to see her kind of like dive into kind of a darker role in the second half.
I'm going to throw a bit of a curveball at this, and I'm going to say Amy Adams.
An actual American? Hang on.
I don't know quite why, but I just like, there's something about her that's just like, I feel like I would want to see her in this. And mainly I'm thinking of her performance in like Arrival, where she's just got a couple of like extra layers to her. But I think it's a little left field, and not like the blonde hair or anything, but all right, so let's talk about The Great Gatsby. I guess we have to take a vote first on the book or the film. So we are looking at the 1925 novel by F. Scott Fitzgerald and the 2013 film directed by Baz Luhrmann. Those are the two we're looking at. So, Lois, book or film?
Book.
Yeah?
Yeah. I don't have a problem with the film. I know a lot of fans of the book did. They thought that, you know, if a seminal Gatsby movie was going to come out, it should be not with like Baz Luhrmann's flair. But I'll sort of give away my thoughts on whether it's a good adaptation here. I think Baz Luhrmann actually got the feel of what The Great Gatsby is going for, and what it's about through his style, quite well. So, I'm gonna go with the novel.
Cool. Megan, how about you?
I'm going to go with the novel, though. I just watched the film for the first time and I really liked it. Can I vote for the soundtrack? Because I definitely listened to the soundtrack back in 2013 quite a bit.
Yeah, well, I will definitely talk more about that when we get to the discussion of it, but it's a very unique soundtrack. I really enjoy it.
Baz Luhrmann's music choices are always on point.
Well, it's Jay-Z is the like co-producer on this, and so obviously he had a big say in the musical direction of it. Yeah. But it's definitely a motivated choice.
Mm-hmm.
I'd say.
Yeah.
I'm going to be the outlier then. I am going to go for the film. I think I did prefer it. I do have a thing for like, a bias more in favor of the more modern book. And there were times where I found like the writing to be a little confusing maybe. But that wasn't to say it was bad. It's just probably not my style. And I did enjoy the movie and kind of the direction that took. And it was, as you've already mentioned, Lois, it was very stylized in a way that brought out the elements that I think the novel goes for.
Mm-hmm.
Is it a good adaptation?
Well, I've kind of given my opinion away. I think it is. I think it gets the central point of The Great Gatsby, which is like talking about excess and how you can cover up a lot of sins by just the facade you put out to the world. And I think it gets that.
Cool. And Megan?
No, I agree. I think it's a great adaptation. I don't think it shies away from the horrors, especially towards the end. And at times it felt a little rushed. Like, there are some things that are weirdly adapted that I could have been left out for better parts later. But overall, I actually was really surprised to enjoy it. And that I think it is pretty close to the book.
Cool. Yeah, I'm again, same camp. I think it's a pretty good adaptation. It's very, very faithful to the source material. Definitely in plot and in character and a lot of the dialogue as well. I think, to be honest, I think it's probably one of the closest, like, dialogue and plot-wise since Lord of the Rings that we've done on the podcast.
Yeah. And that's why I don't understand, like, Baz Luhrmann manages to marry his style with still being really faithful, and I don't understand why some people had such a problem with the adaptation, because I'm like, it's really close, so why are you nitpicking?
I wonder if it's the people that view this as like a romantic love story and throw Gatsby parties that had a problem with it.
Possibly. Maybe people who missed the point.
Yeah.
Possibly.
Yeah.
Alright, so a plot summary for those who are unfamiliar with the story of The Great Gatsby. When Midwesterner Nick Carraway moves to New York, he becomes embroiled in the lives and affairs of those around him, chiefly that of his enigmatic neighbour, Jay Gatsby. So let's talk about the cast of this show. First and foremost, Leonardo DiCaprio as The Great Gatsby himself. What do we think of this choice? Megan, I think you definitely have an opinion on this.
I don't care for him here, and I wonder if it's because I feel like maybe it's 10 years too late to have Leonardo DiCaprio. Like, he just felt old. And, you know, he's supposed to, I don't know, he's supposed to be roughly the same age as Carey Mulligan and Tobey Maguire. And Tobey Maguire feels young, though I think he's also much older. I don't know. It just, it should have felt like Jack Dawson didn't die and became Gatsby. Instead, I was like, Jack Dawson didn't die and aged 20 years, and then tried to pretend to be Gatsby. So I feel like they went for name recognition here, rather than someone who would have fit the role better. There were times where I was like, oh no, he's, like, he does a great job, I just don't think he fits in with the role as well as they could have done.
Yeah. Yeah.
Lois, what did you feel?
I think I agree. I don't know who else I would put in, but I think that, like you said, that it feels like Leonardo DiCaprio is too old and a lot older than Tobey Maguire. But I think Leonardo DiCaprio and Tobey Maguire are actually contemporaries. So it's like, yeah. So it's like, why does he feel so much older? And I think it's probably because he was acting a little bit younger than Tobey Maguire was. Like, he was acting as a kid, and so we've been more familiar with him for longer, and I don't know, I think he did a good job, but maybe it needed a little bit more flair, and I don't know that Leonardo DiCaprio does, like, I'm loath to use the word camp again, because we used it so much in Spider-Man last week, but, like, that kind of feeling to it.
He doesn't feel 1920s.
Yeah.
You could put him in the clothes, and he did the, like, nervousness really well, but he didn't feel 1920s, which is ridiculous because he was fine in Titanic.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think I agree, Lawson, that with your point that it's hard to imagine who else I would have there that would, like, satisfy these criteria. And, I mean, I'm sure we could sit here all day thinking of potential cast members, and I don't recall any information on who else was considered for this role. But, I mean, I think he does it. It's not a bad performance, really. It's again, I think we all seem to have this consensus that there's something just, like, slightly not quite... It's not as, like, a square peg, round hole. Like,
it's more oval peg, round hole.
Yeah, oval peg, yeah. Like, he's close, but not quite.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I agree. To be honest, I think it's funny, because, like, despite the amazing design and costume and set and all that for this film, I just think he even looks older than he should.
Yeah.
Like, because it describes him as being this, the book describes him quite explicitly as being this guy who's, like, appears super young and, like, he shouldn't have all this money for someone that age. And really, he was, like, he would have been, what, like, 20, late 20s at the earliest. He looks like someone in his late 30s.
Yes.
Early 40s. Like, I feel like he always has wrinkles on his forehead almost.
He does. He, like, got wrinkles very young or something. I don't know. But I ended up looking up his age. I mean, he was 39 when this was filming. Compared to, especially having Carrie Mulligan as his leading woman who was in her 20s. It just, when they're supposed to be around the same age, it really, really, it just was off.
Yeah. Maybe he got wrinkles from not getting an Oscar for long enough.
Yeah. He gets a wrinkle every time he doesn't get an Oscar.
That's quite possible.
So Tobey Maguire, as we've already mentioned, stars here as Nick Carraway. This is an interesting one because I feel like, again, I mean, personally, I think he, like, there are some bits where he's really good and some bits where he's just, like, non.
Yeah, I think he, maybe that's partly the character is a little bit nothing. And so he's doing the best of what he's got. I actually think he does a really good job. He's quite warm and funny. And I like the little bits, like, the bit where he's like, perhaps more flowers to Gatsby, you know, and I think he does a good job of being not maybe so reserved and kind of odd as the character in the book, and a bit more of an interesting audience insert than maybe the narrator in the book is.
Yeah, they take a different direction with him as well, like, because the book obviously has him just as the narrator and not you, so he gets a lot of time to discuss his own morals and, mm-hmm. and his, like, outlook on life, whereas the film is framed with him as a writer trying, you know, getting back into the swing of writing as a patient of alcoholism,
mm-hmm.
Which is their framework, which allows him to narrate, basically. So there's some story element behind that. But I think I agree. I think he's also hampered by the fact that this character is hard to portray.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't think he does a bad job. It's just that there are some parts where this character is just like, I mean, and to be fair, it's not called The Great Nick Carraway. This story is about Gatsby.
I was saying beforehand, I would have liked to see them incorporate some of the very well-known reading of this, that Nick Carraway is actually gay. And his part of his obsession is with Gatsby is that he's actually in love with him as well. Like, even a nod to that would have been good. Obviously, that's not explicit in the book, so they don't have to include it. But
yeah.
I think it's a fairly common reading of the character, so I would have liked to see it included.
Yeah. Carey Mulligan as Daisy Buchanan.
So I'm very much in love with Carey Mulligan, and I can see why she went back to indie roles after this. I still think she does an amazing job, but it's not my favorite role of hers. Like, she doesn't lean... I don't know if she just doesn't get enough screen time or if she just doesn't lean into how I view Daisy, which is just really, really shallow and flighty. And it's almost kind of shocking that she doesn't go with Gatsby in the end of the movie. As we're in the book, I was like, oh, she's never leaving her husband. But I don't know, I got a different vibe in the movie. But I still loved her, and I find it hilarious that, like, most of this cast is not American. But I at no point thought her accent was weird, which, like, is two thumbs up. Because I think this was the first time she did an American accent in a movie, and I think it... Usually I'm thrown off, because you can always tell it's someone faking an accent, but I think she does a great job.
Yeah, I totally agree with that feeling that she's, like, not playing the character as ditzy and shallow as it needs to be. That maybe another actress would have given it more of that. Not that she doesn't do a good job, because I think she does a good job, but it's just, yeah, it's a shock when she doesn't leave with Gatsby, even though when you've read the book, you know that she's not going to, but it's like, in the movie, you get the feeling that she will, because she's she seems strong and independent.
Yeah, and she's like on board literally until the very last second, until he throws that punch, which is a different, like, that's plot-wise, so we will bring that up in that very crucial scene, I'm sure.
Yeah.
But alongside her is, as Tom Buchanan, is Joel Edgerton, who I think is probably nails this character the most out of any of the main cast.
Yeah, I agree.
He's the perfect asshole.
Yeah. Yeah, I really love Joel Edgerton's, portrayal of this character. I think the character's well written. I also don't think it's a particularly difficult character to portray, because it's just a bolshy, horrible, entitled man, you know? Yeah. So
hypocritical.
Like, yeah, it's just a hyper-masculine, like, just do everything that we kind of frown on today kind of thing.
Very true.
Yeah, so, like, it's not... You just have to embody that and then you're kind of there. But I still really love his portrayal of Tom Buchanan, and I think all the moments where he's on screen were really, like, liven up the movie.
Yeah.
And that's an interesting thing to say about a Baz Luhrmann movie, where there's always a lot of things happening.
Yep. Then we have Elizabeth Debicki as Jordan Baker. Now, she was, if I read right, this was literally her first ever role, like, literally right out of an Australian theatre college.
Really?
So she walked right into quite a big film.
I liked her. I thought she played just enough snarkiness. I don't like the direction they took necessarily with the character, but I think she did great for what she was given.
Yeah, I think they give her a lot less to do in this than she does in the book.
Right.
And you know, that might be necessary for focus reasons or something like that. But I think she does a good job of playing the character. I did like the amusing shot when she's first introduced, and, like, because the book, his first description of her is that, like, she turns her nose up at almost everything. And then, like, when you see her in the movie, she's reading a magazine where the front image is a woman with her nose up, and, like, she's almost copying that exact pose.
Yeah.
It was very amusing, but she's got that perfect, like, high class,
yeah,
don't care, but also interested in everything sort of attitude.
I feel like they maybe took some of the, how she's a lady who just goes about on her own business, and she doesn't, need a chaperone, and, you know, she plays sports and she rides horses, and, you know, they took a bit of that kind of don't care independence and gave it to Daisy, which is then the problem. Whereas, like, Daisy is interested in Jordan only because Jordan is she's basically latched onto Jordan because Jordan is interesting, not because Daisy is interesting. And, like, that's not portrayed in the film. It's like, they're both as interesting as each other, whereas in actuality, Daisy's not interesting at all.
Yeah. And then finally we have, finally for our cast list as well, a very minor role, we have Isla Fisher as Myrtle Wilson.
I love Isla Fisher.
I do love Isla Fisher, and I was sad when I saw that she was playing this, because I'm like, you are going to die, and this is very sad.
Yeah.
I'm surprised they got her for such a small role, but yeah, she does it so well.
Yeah, she really, like, hams up. It's funny, because I think this scene here, like, the party that she, like, spends most of her screen time in, actually is one of the few scenes, I think, that the movie helped to realize more than the book. You know, like, having those visuals really helped that scene.
It did annoy me, though, when I read the book, and it was like, Myrtle's, like, a plump woman with a big bottom, like, and, you know, huge hips, and her dress is straining over hips, and I'm like, they got fucking Isla Fisher? Really? 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 Like, a stick insect. Are you, like, get a larger lady. Like, if she's specifically described as being, like, a big lady, get a big lady to do it. Like, yeah, that annoyed me a little bit, but, I do love Isla Fisher.
She's fine, yeah.
Yeah, she's fine. She's a great actress, and she does a good job, but, like, specifically she's described as a large lady. Like, it specifically goes on and on about how, you know, her skirt straining over her huge buttocks and all of this, and I'm like, well, that's not the case with Isla Fisher. She's tiny.
Not at all.
So briefly before we move on to the plot, the set and costumes, this one, like, Academy Award for Best Costume Design, and I think for Best, like, Production Design or something.
Baz Luhrmann films are always so beautiful, so full of, like, rich colour, and they do their research on, like, period costumes, but then they add their own kind of style to it, and, yeah, I mean... You can't criticize it. It's just, it's a spectacle.
Yeah,
you know what you're going to get going in.
Yeah, I think especially like the two main images I have of this that I was like giving kudos to this film for is the ash like heap place. I can't remember the what's it called? I literally wrote, the Valley of Ashes. So that the realization of that kind of like in between spot between the wealthy villages and between New York City itself was really well done. But then the parties.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Like the parties are the primo scenes in this film, and like the dancing and the music, you know, which is an amazing decision. And it's very deliberate in that, like, the music here is almost a character. It's not backgrounded. Like, this music is in your face, and like you're supposed to notice it.
Mm.
And it's very deliberate. And that, the costume, it just all comes together to create this, like, over the top, larger than life thing, which is what this, you know, rich society is all about, you know, like flaunting wealth.
Mm.
So
I also wonder if partly the choice in music is, and like the choice of using, of Jay-Z being like the music producer, is a partly a commentary, or you could see it as a commentary, because this movie is very, this whole story is very white, and it actually has a plot line in it about how Tom Buchanan is basically a white supremacist, he is a white supremacist, and he believes in separation of the races. He believes that, you know, people that are not white should be held down by people who are white, and if they don't do that, then they're going to be quote-unquote overcome by the other races. And so I think it's interesting that they would have an African-American, like, rapper basically produce the music and have that kind of feel to the music in the film. And I really feel like you could really delve into a lot of, like, the commentary that says about this and kind of taking the power out of that storyline. Yeah, I could talk about that a lot, but obviously we don't have time. But yeah, I really, really like that as a choice because of that plot line.
Yep. All right, so let's talk about the plot.
Okay.
So we open up with Nick moving into New York, into the dumbest two town names ever, to West Egg.
West Egg.
Oh, just the word egg, really, like, having to read it so many times, really grated on me. I was like, ugh, that's the worst place name ever.
Is this a real thing? Do they call
West Egg and East Egg are fictional.
No, okay. It's Kings Point, I think, is the real place.
Okay.
Yeah.
Like, what a weird thing to call it.
Yeah, go figure. Maybe F. Scott Fitzgerald was having a bad day.
He was just a weird man. I mean, honestly.
Yeah, he moves into West Egg, which is kind of the new money town, although he doesn't move into a new money house. He moves into like this little gardening cottage, which is stuck in between two great mansions. And then East Egg, which is on the other side of the river, like facing opposite almost, is the old money town, so the blooded money.
Yeah.
I was just going to say, I don't know how much you guys know about Manhattan, but the Upper East Side is old money versus the Upper West Side, which is supposedly new money. Both sides are ridiculously overpriced, but it's still the same kind of, you don't cross the Central Park line kind of thing. So it's also playing into that, which I don't know if that's the same back in the 1920s, but that is how it is nowadays.
Yeah, I was going to say, isn't it also the perception that the eastern states, like the eastern seaboard, is old money and the western seaboard is, because that's like the western seaboard is like Hollywood and that kind of thing.
Yeah.
That would be like your more new money, and then your New York and New Hampshire and that kind of thing is old money.
Yep, you moved west if you needed to start over.
Yeah. Yeah, so I didn't know about the specific New York thing, but that I thought that's what that was referencing, like that east coast, west coast kind of thing.
Yeah. I totally didn't think of that because Hollywood, California, it's just so much money these days that I just don't think about it. But yeah, that does work.
So the first kind of plot thing we have is Nick having dinner with Daisy. Well, we should mention as well, so this is probably one of the first big points of difference, and we kind of have already mentioned it, is that the film is framed through the lens of Nick Carraway in a psychiatric place being helped for alcoholism.
Yeah,
he looks really
this.
Ragged in this opening scene, as like he's supposed to, you know, this, which is supposed to be him feeling the effects of this whole ordeal, I guess. But and he's like an ex-writer, which he also was in the book, but he's kind of getting back into writing as part of his treatment for this, is writing about the story of Gatsby. And that framing kind of allows him to narrate this film.
To the psychiatrist. Yeah.
It's a weird choice because I don't know. The way the movie, I'm trying to figure out what I'm trying to say, other than like it kind of feels like he's making this whole situation about him. By putting him there without having any kind of, like, if he was in love with Gatsby, to go back to that, and then all this happened and it caused him to break, and having, like, the realization, you know, that he had feelings for Gatsby, like, that would make sense why he ended up in a mental institution, but I don't know. It's very strange.
Yeah, no, I think the film doesn't do it a lot of, like, it doesn't dwell on explaining exactly why it's in here, why he's in here. You just assume that is the case.
Yeah.
Whereas, like, for us who'd read the book, and, like, it does seem weird that all of a sudden he's in a mental institution.
Yeah.
Because in the book, to fix his problems, he just moves back home into, the West.
Yeah.
The Midwest.
Yeah. Especially because they keep the line about how he's only been drunk twice. And if you're an alcoholic, like, you kind of spend... Or at least most of the ones I know, like, have a low-grade buzz almost all the time. So it's weird to keep that line in, but also have him here for this reason.
Anyway, the film doesn't dwell on it, so...
Yeah, it is... Yeah, I do think, though, they did need to give him a reason to be narrating. And if they weren't just going to go with, well, he's writing his memories, which is... Would have been fine, because that's how the book starts, is like, let me tell you the story of this thing that happened to me.
They do kind of half and half, don't they? They're like, half of it he's talking to the doctor and half of it he's typing on his typewriter.
Yeah, and the book literally is like, hey, this thing happened to me. I'm going to tell you all about it in this book that I'm writing. So the book, like, basically F. Scott Fitzgerald tells you when you start, this book was written by Nick Carraway. I'm just publishing it kind of thing. And so for the movie not to do that, it's a bit weird, but... I guess they felt they needed something more interesting for the character, because he is a bit of a nothing. I don't know. I just wanted them to go with the gay thing.
I know, now that you've said it, I'm like, but here are all the ways we missed out.
I just want more gay characters in everything.
Yeah.
All the time, forever.
So Nick goes to dinner with Daisy, who is his cousin. This is in East Egg, and here he's introduced to Jordan Baker, who's a female golfer, kind of a bit of a... You know, socialite.
He's a polo player in the book, but yeah.
Yep. So they have a bit of a, you know, this is just introducing you to a bunch of the characters. So Tom Buchanan's also here as well. And then on his way home, he lives next door to this big mansion. He sees this figure out on the dock who, they phrase this really funnily, like, in the future he will know this is Gatsby, but right now he didn't know that it was Gatsby, but it was Gatsby.
Yeah.
And so this figure out on the dock is, like, reaching out to this green flashing light, which Nick knows is, like, the buoy light from Daisy's house.
Does he know it's Daisy's house at this point, though? I don't think he does. I think he knows it's just from the other side.
Oh,
I don't think he knows that his and Gatsby's house are directly across from Daisy and Tom's. Yeah. I think, especially, because I remember in the book, he was like, oh, it was just coming from the other side. Yeah. So I think the realization that it's specifically across from Daisy's doesn't come till later.
Yeah. So he sees this flashing light and this character just reaching out towards it in the darkness.
Yeah.
And then we go to the Valley of Ashes. So Jordan, in one of their, like, just dinners or teas or whatever, tells Nick that Tom has a mistress in this Valley of Ashes. So the Valley of Ashes is, like, almost a dumping sort of, like, it's a coal mining part of, like, it's the gross industrial, like, residue part.
Yeah, it's not the suburbs, but it has houses, but it's also not fully industrial.
So it's in between the main city of New York and then these suburbs of East and West Egg, which are further out. Is this based on anything? Do you know, Megan? Is there like an area that is like, obviously New York now is like, I imagine there's nothing particularly like this, but was there something historically that this is true?
I wouldn't be surprised if there was. I don't know enough about Long Island really, to know where exactly that's supposed to be in the history of that area. But I know that there are some really industrial parts when I take the Long Island Railroad out. So, like, there's some parts where, like, only staff can get out kind of thing. So I wouldn't be surprised. And I wouldn't be surprised if they haven't changed much, except for now there are houses because there's houses everywhere. And I wish I did know, but I don't.
So, yes, Jordan tells Nick that Tom has a mistress here in the Valley of Ashes, and as Tom and Nick are going into the city one day, they actually just, like, hop off of the train that they're on to pop into this garage where George Wilson works and his wife, Myrtle, who is way out of George Wilson's league. Like, how did that happen? and so they both live there, and Myrtle is Tom's mistress. And so he sends her off on the next train into New York, and then they, like, just pop on after, I assume.
Yeah.
George is, like, not very bright.
Yeah.
And he's a mechanic and just not particularly
And
smart.
He's very awed by Tom.
Yes.
So...
Because of the money.
Yeah. So he doesn't... I think that's part of it as well, that he doesn't really even suspect Tom because he's like, this is a great man. Like, what can I do for him? Like, and he... It's kind of that thing where he thinks, like, oh, well, because he's moneyed and he has old money and that kind of thing, he's, of course, he wouldn't be doing anything bad. Do you know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
There's nothing to suspect because he's, money means you're a good person kind of thing.
Yep. And so then they all have this big party in New York, and Nick gets roaring drunk, and so does everyone. I like how, like, Nick, for all his morals and stuff, is just, like, cool with everyone having all these affairs, and like literally everyone is cheating on everyone.
He moralizes for the whole book, but he never actually does anything to stop anyone getting into these.
Doesn't condemn anyone.
He doesn't condemn anyone. He doesn't tell.
There is that line at the beginning where he's like, I don't judge people.
Yeah.
But then you can't say that you're like, that you have these morals if you don't do that.
Exactly. By not interfering and stopping, like, he basically could have stopped, spoilers, Gatsby's death. By, like, interfering in the situation, like, possibly, like, he knew the tensions, he knew both sides, and by not interfering, he's not being moral, because he's choosing to turn a blind eye to a huge conflict. It's like, yeah, it's very weird.
Yeah, you suck, Nick.
But where would you expect him to draw the line? I mean...
Yeah, I don't know.
Well, I assume that kind of money, it's just known that people have
Daisy's his
mistresses.
Daisy's his family. Like, even if he couldn't take her away, he could contact somebody, like, because
she's like a second cousin once removed. It's not like...
Yeah, it would be weird. Like, there's a whole weird dynamic there that we don't really need to explore. But it's just funny that he's, like, the moral character who really has no, like... inclination towards preventing any of this mold behavior. So he gets invited to a party of Gatsby's.
Mm-hmm.
So he knows that, like, his next door neighbor has these, you know, parties where just people just show up, like all the time. Like it's constantly 24/7, like on the weekends partying. And no, so he shows up at the party. No one else seems to have an invite. Like people just come to these because of the reputation of the party. And he meets Jordan while he's here. And she gets the inclination to go and find Gatsby because Gatsby is typically very reclusive and almost like never shows himself at these parties despite the fact that they're his. And a lot of people there seem to think that like he doesn't actually exist. But he does. Spoilers.
Spoilers.
But does he?
I really like how they find Gatsby, or like how Nick finds Gatsby almost by like total accident.
Yeah.
So he's just like as he's wandering around the party, he like ends up talking to someone who he thinks is like a butler or a waiter or something.
Yeah.
And this as he's conversing with this character, like because there's all these rumors going around that Gatsby, you know, that once killed a man or that he's related to like some Russian drug lord and all these sorts of crazy rumors. And as he's revealing these, it's revealed that he's talking to Gatsby.
Yeah. I also like the bit where like. You get the first, I think it's the first glimpse you get of Leonardo DiCaprio where he, like, basically does a turn to camera and, like, is revealed by, like, I think.
It's the big smile with the martini glass.
Yeah.
Which I'm glad they put in because that's, you know, that's a big part of the scene in the book is he had this smile that made you, you believe in yourself and that he knew you inside and out.
Yeah. I really like that, like, reveal of him. Because, again, it's, like, it's so, like, almost, like, love blossoming. You know? Like,
I hate to tell you, Lois, he's not going to get gay just by you talking about it.
He's not going to get gay because he is gay. This is a very standard reading of this book.
it's a good little introduction to Gatsby here. And as they're, like, talking, he kind of, like, invites Nick out to go on his hydroplane, which apparently was a thing.
I was really glad we didn't get a scene of that because, man, I did not need that.
Yeah.
Not a fan of air travel?
I work in aviation insurance. I don't like planes and movies.
And then Gatsby takes Jordan into like this into his house to talk because he wants to talk to her. And that's kind of like the end of the scene. Like Jordan like just disappears at the end of the party and is like, call me Nick.
Yeah.
They focus a lot less on the relationship between like Jordan and Nick in this as well. So the book has them like, they're basically seeing each other.
Yeah.
Whereas in this, the film, they're kind of like, they're kind of seeing each other, but it's not really ever a thing.
Are they seeing each other in the book? Because I just figured they kept getting thrown together and like.
Well, I think he says at some point in the book, doesn't he, that he starts seeing her?
I guess. I don't know. I just always felt like she kind of.
Even if they are seeing each other, they never actually like. Then you never get the feeling that they're actually in love.
No, she definitely. It's just like convenience. Like, oh, you're here for the summer, and I haven't hung out with you before, so like, you don't bore me yet. Kind of vibe.
Yeah, he seems to be one of the people she can tolerate.
Yeah, and so I never took it as they were dating, other than just like. A good excuse to have someone to talk to at a party.
Yeah, or maybe it was convenient to let people think they were.
Yeah, I mean, it probably was. When you're pushing 30 in the 1920s and you're single, dude, why are you still single?
Yeah, and also for her, because she wants to be able to go where she wants and do what she wants.
Exactly.
Yep. So if she has a quote-unquote, like, chaperone in him, then, you know, she can do more.
Exactly.
So we start to get this like friendship between Gatsby and Nick. As he's driving them into the city one day, he just starts like revealing some of his past. You know that he went to Oxford and that he was like a big game hunter and looking for rubies in Africa and all these sorts of like stories that Nick thinks isn't true. But then he like shows him his Montenegrin Medal of Valor or whatever it is,
yeah,
and his Oxford photo.
But also, you do still not know whether. Like, obviously some of the stories are true, but, like, Gatsby has to be one of the most unreliable narrators in fiction. Like, I mean, he's not the narrator, but, like, he's going to say what he wants to say, isn't he?
Yeah, but the writing in the book and the movie do give you, like, the impression that even though, like, he has evidence that it's not, there's something else that's not quite right about the thing. So I did like the both book and movie, like, still maintain that narration to let you know that.
Yeah.
I really liked the scene in the book. Like, we get all this stuff about Gatsby. In the movie, it just felt really weird. Like, he's got him trapped in a car, driving really fast. And, like, I just want to give you all this information about me because, like, I don't know. It's just done in such a weird way of, like, of course he's lying. Like, who gives that much information about themselves right up front?
Yeah, I think that scene in the film was actually a little, like, jarring all of a sudden that Gatsby was, like, this terrible driver who just, like, I'm not sure whether they were trying to, like, symbolize that he was, like, swerving a lot.
Yeah.
But, like, that it was very awkward all of a sudden that, like, he was just in this car, like, side to side all over the road, not really safe or anything like that.
Yeah. They're in the, partly going through the Valley of Ashes in this section, right?
Yes.
Yeah,
because he sees Myrtle in the window, I think, yeah. At one point.
Is it maybe, like, symbolic of him being on Tom's turf?
I mean, I'm not going to lie, that's just kind of how New Yorkers drive.
Yeah, Australians are, like, reading way too much into this, yeah, and like, just like, no, that's just how it went.
Like, the actual driving didn't bother me, it just felt trapped more than anything.
Yeah.
So they get into New York City and they go to a speakeasy, where, Gatsby is familiar, like he's known, and, we're introduced to Maya Wolfsheim, I hope I'm pronouncing that all right, who is, like, what do you call him? His job sort of, like, he's a swindler? He's like a con man? He rigged the 1919 World Series and like he's...
Is he a loan shark?
I can't really pin down what he is. He's a bunch of things. He's a criminal, effectively.
Yeah.
Yeah. They call him a gambler in the movie.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's more to it than that, but he's, you know, a sinister individual for the purpose of this. So it's supposed to give you the indication that Gatsby is up to some not particularly legal activities.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I didn't read too much into this, but at least, like, one thing I said that was, like, actual human teeth. In his, like, cufflinks and stuff. I really hope that's not true, but also it's kind of awesome if it is.
And then that afternoon at tea, Jordan reveals the first big kind of plot point of the film, which is that Gatsby knew Daisy once upon a time, 5 years ago, and he wants Nick to organize a meeting between them at tea, like in a couple days.
Yeah.
So this is the first big kind of reveal as to Gatsby's character, as to his motivations.
Yeah.
And so we get the reunion kind of scene next. So at this little cottage.
The best moment in the film with all the flowers.
Yes. So many flowers.
Yeah, it's good. So Gatsby like comes over to Nick's house because that's where he's invited Daisy to tea. And like Nick's house is like this, it's a small abandoned gardening cottage that is now done up as a house.
Yeah.
Like, and it's still in the shadow of these like mansions either side of it.
Yeah.
But Gatsby arrives in the morning with like 12 servants carrying like huge, massive like flower displays that he just basically fills the living room with.
Yeah.
It's an amusing vision.
And then Nick gets to be sassy to him, which is great.
But Gatsby's, like, super nervous, like, when Daisy's not there at, like, 2 minutes to, he's like, I need to go home, this was all a terrible idea.
Yeah.
He's worried about the rain, he's worried about, like, his appearance, all that sort of stuff. He's like a little schoolboy with a crush.
Yeah.
Maybe the book does this a little bit better, but, like, this is kind of, you know why he's so nervous, because this is, like, everything he's dreamed about for 5 years is finally, like, coming back to him.
Yeah, and I think Leonardo DiCaprio, like we said before, he does a really good job in these scenes.
He really does.
Yeah, so he definitely acts up a storm here.
Yeah, those wrinkles help him look worried.
The rain cancels them out.
And so Daisy arrives, and as soon as like she enters the flower room, and like you just kind of see her looking into the room, and you don't see what's in the room where Gatsby was getting himself ready, and then. When Nick walks in, he's like, he doesn't see Gatsby because Gatsby's disappeared. And like, he rocks up like a minute later and he's like done a walk around the block in the rain. Because he's just like so afraid of like, he just can't bring himself to meet like her. It's, like, his anticipation's so high. But they reunite and they get to talking and are very, very in love with each other again.
Yeah.
How sweet.
Yeah.
And so they start having an affair.
Yeah.
My question is, because I think what I really liked about the book and the movie is that it's like there's no real implication that they even have an affair. Like every summer you read, it's like, and they had an affair for the summer, but did they? Like, I don't know. It just feels like Gatsby was kind of willing to wait for her to leave. It wasn't like he wanted her to really cheat on her husband. It was kind of, it felt more chaste to me, but everything I read was like, and they had an affair for the summer. I'm like, did they?
Yeah. It's definitely like, to me, it was like emotional affair, not.
Oh, without like, a doubt. Yeah.
Yeah. Like they definitely wanted to be having an affair, but he didn't want her to like not be, I guess, like he didn't, I guess he wouldn't have wanted to mar like her purity with like sinning, you know, that kind of idea. And like, and she, I think it fits that they didn't actually, weren't actually physical, because I can see her not, I can see her stringing him along and not wanting to actually seal the deal with him.
Definitely. Just to piss off her husband.
Yeah, like she likes that he's infatuated with her, definitely. And but she maybe wouldn't go as far as to have sex with him because she doesn't actually have any intention of leaving her husband, and it would complicate the situation enormously if she did that.
But they do in the movie, don't they?
They do in the movie, but I don't think that that's actually necessarily true in the book.
I mean, especially through Nick's eyes, it's not like, I mean, the movie, he's kind of creepy almost.
Yeah,
he's
it would
like
be
walking around watching. But
it would be so weird if Nick was like, and then they had sex.
Exactly.
I mean, I assume they did anyway. Not that I was there.
Not that I was there.
Not totally there.
I was there in the corner.
Oh.
Gross.
Oh.
The Great Gatsby.
And I saw his littler Gatsby.
The lesser Gatsby.
The lesser spotted Gatsby. Gross. Oh. Gross.
Right, that's the end of this podcast.
No, and then I saw why they call him the Great Gatsby.
Oh my gosh.
Wow.
Ha ha, wieners.
And Gatsby's kind of disappointed because Daisy kind of wants to run away, whereas Gatsby doesn't want to leave his life behind. He wants her to be a part of that.
Yeah.
And so he's kind of like, no, you need to tell Tom that you don't love him, really.
I don't know if it's he doesn't want to leave his life behind or if he just feels that, like, she shouldn't have to, because of course she doesn't love her husband. She loves Gatsby.
Yeah.
Yeah, like, it's very clear that, I mean, both from Leonardo's performance and, like, the writing in the book, that this character actually, like, he almost doesn't believe that they're married. He's like, their marriage is a sham, and she's literally just been waiting for me for 5 years, and this is, like, this stopgap.
Yeah, and I also definitely feel that part of the reason he doesn't want to run away is that he wants to rub Tom's face in it.
Yeah, definitely.
He wants her to leave Tom for him, and then he wants Tom to have to see him in society with his wife, his ex-wife, and know that she left him for him.
Part of
he
it
wants
is
to, he wants Tom to be upset.
A big part of him, this character though, is like the money thing, because like we get the story of Dan Cody and you know how he, you know, was rescued this guy on a boat and learned from this guy for years and years. The movie tells you less about it than the book does.
Yeah.
But that also kind of like, this is why I think that Gatsby like it doesn't actually think that you know their marriage is really really worth anything, is because he only thinks that she wasn't with him because of money, because he didn't have any. And so yeah. What did she do? She married a guy who had money.
And
for security's sake, not for love's sake.
Yeah, but
because he can only see in his head that money is the only like value.
But yeah, but unfortunately he's right.
Well, yeah,
she
in society.
She is with Tom for his money, and at the end of the day, Tom is more secure than he is, so she stays with him.
I mean, there's just something about old money and those connections.
Yeah.
That's just, you can't, I mean, especially in the movie where, you know, Gatsby's like, I have just as much money as you, and Tom's like, you think that's all that it is, but it's not. It's completely different. Everybody in this room is different than you are, and it's true, like.
Yeah.
You've got to get several generations in before it stops being quote-unquote new money.
Yeah.
I want to go to these people and be like, well, you talk about all your new money and your old money, but have you tried no money?
But that's the thing, is like there are these families that are considered old money now that don't have any money, but they still have that prestige and those connections. Yeah. And it's baffling. Like,
yeah, fuck that end of society, man.
Like Chris Hardwick's wife, I don't think that family is worth like even half of what they were back in the 20s. And I'm totally blanking on which.
That's the newspaper company.
Yeah. There were two big newspapers in the 1920s. And, and her mom like got pulled into a cult. Their whole family is so much fun to read about, but I don't think they have the money that they... Is she a Hearst? She's a Hearst.
She a Hearst, that's right, yeah.
But yet, like, that name alone carries so much weight. So, and she's fine. She's got plenty of money. I mean, she's an actress and a model and whatever. But it's not anything
like what
they
have. She is unfortunately married to Chris Hardwick.
Yeah, that's her own choice, so.
So, and then we cut to, in the film, the worst day of all time. So it begins with, like, all five going for lunch at the Buchanan house. Now, Gatsby has kind of arranged this because he wants Nick and Jordan to both be there as kind of, like, these, like, sick witnesses to him and Daisy revealing to Tom that Daisy doesn't love him, and they are now going to start their life together.
Just a terrible plan.
Yeah, awful plan. Terrible plan. Bad idea. So they all go for lunch at the Buchanan house. It's a very hot day in the book, and kind of in the movie. And Tom becomes suspicious of like how intimate Gatsby and Daisy get at certain moments, because they are like he's just like, he doesn't even just say it straight up. He's just like, oh. And he's, like, overly flirty and, like, brushes her hand or something. Just this weird level of intimacy that they have.
But again, this is all male posturing.
Oh, it is, absolutely.
This is all for Tom's benefit. This isn't for... He's telling himself it's because it's for Daisy, because he loves her. But actually, he just wants to rub Tom's face in it. He wants Tom to see, and he wants Tom to be jealous.
Yeah, and it's a terrible plan.
Yeah.
Because Tom's bigger than he is.
Yeah.
And Tom naturally becomes suspicious of Gatsby and Daisy during the day, and they decide to go to the city. Daisy's, like, starting to freak out because she can, like, feel the tension between the two of them. She suggests they go to the city, and then eventually Tom picks up and he's like, no, let's go. Come on, let's do it. Let's play this out. Because you get the feeling, like, because he obviously already knows Gatsby's backstory, because he's done research into who Gatsby actually is.
Yeah.
And as he knows this, like, he kind of has his own cards. So they're both, like, kind of playing this weird, sick game of poker with each other. And as they go into the city, they take each other's cars in some sort of, like, again, masculine posturing.
That was weird.
Thing. Yeah. And so they take the car. So Gatsby and Daisy go in Tom's car, and Tom and Nick and Jordan go in Gatsby's car, and it's almost running out of gas, so they have to stop by Wilson's in the Valley of Ashes, where we see that, where Wilson tells Tom, this is very confusing because all the characters are coming into play at this point, that he suspects Myrtle of infidelity, and that he's moving them both west whether she likes it or not.
Yeah.
And Myrtle, being Tom's lover, also we haven't mentioned the fact that Tom just like, it is... Like, how can he have any sort of justification for...
Oh, because women are property.
Yeah, exactly. But he's equally, like, more disgusting.
You notice that, like, none of the women get any say in any of this. It's literally Gatsby being like, my property, and Tom being like, no, my property, and them having a dick measuring contest about whose property this woman is. Like, seriously, it's really, really gross. And so this is what really annoys me when people describe this book as a great love story. It's like, no, it's not.
It's a great dick measuring contest.
Yeah, like, that's like describing Lolita as a love story. It's like, you've missed the point. And people do that, by the way. I've been on, I read Lolita, and then I was like, perusing the comments on Goodreads, and I was like, how have these people missed the point of this book so much? Oh my god.
Yeah.
Bring us back. So Wilson, he's had taken Myrtle off, so Tom is now freaking out because he's about to lose. He's not secure in the fact that he thinks he's won Daisy at this point. Like, he has his own cards to play, but like I like the way that the book describes him as kind of like he feels both of them slipping away now. And so he's kind of been backed into this corner where he will react. And they get to the Plaza Hotel. They're like, it's very hot, so they're all just kind of like chilling. They literally have like buckets of ice that they're just drenching themselves in. And Daisy's freaking out, and the dick measuring contest comes to a head. As
gross.
Yep. Well, that's where it ends, man. What do you want me to say?
Why did you do phrasing like that?
Oh, that phrasing was wonderful. Thank you.
Oh, gross. The worst imagery.
And Gatsby's like, hello, I'm sleeping with your wife.
Yeah. I really like Leonardo DiCaprio because he has this look and it is pure innocent and belief that Daisy loves him and could have never loved her husband truly, which I know happens in the book too. But he does it so well that I was like, oh, this isn't just like a weird ploy. You truly believe this.
Mm. Yeah, he's deluded because this is like all his entire person has been about for 5 years, and so he just cannot think of anything else or drive himself towards anything else or accurately look, like step back and take perspective on the situation. Like, he can't reevaluate. He's on one course and one course only. So after he tells Tom this, and they, you know, go back and forth over who loves her, who loves who, and Tom says, oh, you know, you don't understand. You know, you are. This new money, and you know, you got it in bootlegging, you know, you're associated with shady characters. And oh god, it's just like this huge fight, and it almost comes to a fight, fisticuffs, as kind of Gatsby, as he realizes what's happening, and like that he's also losing grip on Daisy, who's starting to freak and go to her security of the last 5 years. Like, she's kind of pushing back in that direction. At least she is in the book anyway. The movie is not. Let's talk about this now, I guess, because the movie where she's like, she decides just to go with Tom doesn't feel as justified as the book does.
Yeah, well, because it's been, I think it's partly because the movie's been so explicit, like literally explicit, with them having sex. So you feel like she is more invested and in Gatsby. And less, and therefore less invested in her husband. Whereas I think, like we were saying before, where it's left up to the reader to be like, decide how much of an affair, like, I mean, an affair is an affair, but like, how much is Gatsby kidding himself, I guess. When it's left up to the reader to decide, it's not surprising at all when she stays with her husband, because you're like, oh, okay, this was all in Gatsby's head. But as soon as you show that she has been willing to sleep with him and have a physical relationship with him, then you're going, well, okay, why has she done all that then if she's just going to stay with her husband? It makes her seem really kind of not in her own mind, like not someone who can make her own decisions.
I think in the book there's a scene where Gatsby meets her daughter, which is almost entirely left out of the movie. Like, I know she's mentioned, but I feel like there was a scene, and it's kind of a moment for Gatsby to be like, this relationship is some kind of real. Like, or at least for me reading, it was like, yeah, they definitely had something because there's a child. And there's no hint of sexual assault or anything like that. Like, she loves this kid, and it's not a tainted kind of reason. And with the kid entirely absent from the movie, there's nothing to ground this relationship with her husband.
I love this kid, because this kid like comes in this one scene in the book, and other than that, like, I know, and it does serve a purpose, as you've just been talking about, to kind of, like, I agree, because that's exactly what I thought when I was reading that scene, but I just find it funny that, like, this kid's mentioned this, like, one time in the book, and then it's just, like, discarded. And even in the book, like, after Daisy, like, sees a kid, she almost, like, doesn't think it. It says explicitly, she, like, Daisy didn't really think about the kid again after that.
Yeah.
Like, in that moment.
It definitely adds to her shallowness and her flightiness in the book. And it's almost, this is why Gatsby has to become so physical in the movie. Like, him throwing things around the room shocked me, at least. I was like, wait, I almost always got the vibe that Gatsby, while he did fight in a war and does make his money through illegal ways, is not a violent man. So to really lean into that was just one of the times where I was like, okay, this feels like a different vibe.
Yeah, but I think when you're reading it on the reading it with the lens of men's entitlement to women, his anger and throwing stuff around the room does make sense, and like the fact that he's gonna throw a punch and that kind of thing, because that makes it hormonal, you know, it makes it testosterone fueled, and so then it does make sense, like, that it's not actually about his feelings for Daisy, it's about his testosterone and his toxic masculinity telling him that he's being denied the woman that he deserves because he's done everything that he has told himself because of his toxic masculinity that he had to do to get her, and now she is denying herself to him, and her husband's denying her to him, so now he's going to chuck a tantrum. So when you look at through that lens, you're like, oh, well, it does make sense.
So, yeah, Daisy, when she's asked, like, what Gatsby says, so, you know, just tell him that you never loved him, or, you know, go and talk to me alone so we can, you know, talk this out. And she says, even alone, I can't say that I never loved him. I did love him at some point, even if now she feels more emotionally attached to Gatsby. She feels more financially attached and family attached, I guess, by, like, just purely the 5 years that they've been together to Tom, even if she knows that he's cheating himself.
But also, you don't feel like their relationship is maybe fully unsalvageable, like Tom's and hers. Like, you feel like they've become estranged, but because they have a child together, and because of the, like, I know nowadays, like, that would probably just cause them split up, but, like, the time period, I know they do talk a bit about divorce in the book and stuff, but, like, it was still largely frowned upon, and, like, you feel like maybe if they go away together and away from all of this, that maybe they can make it work.
Yeah. So at this point, once she says that she loved both men, Tom knows that he's effectively won this fight.
Yeah.
And he sends Gatsby and Daisy off in the yellow car. And the others, they just hang around. They do Nick and Jordan and Tom until Tom's ready to go. Because he's basically, he knows that they can be alone together. And that Gatsby can't actually do anything because Daisy won't stay with him at the expense of, like, she won't divorce Tom to be with him. And so we get to the drive home. And as Nick and Jordan and Tom all go through the Valley of Ashes, they stop by an incident that's happened outside of Wilson's where Myrtle has been killed by a yellow car.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so there's, like, a lot of, like, oh, who done it here? As to, like, you know, what Wilson thinks and what Tom thinks. Tom's obviously not thrilled that his, like, mistress has died.
Mm-hmm.
And when it's revealed that the yellow car did, he assumes that Gatsby was the one who killed Myrtle, you know, out of a revenge, I guess. And he tells Wilson that Gatsby did it, and
that Gatsby was the one having an affair with Myrtle.
Yes.
Yeah.
And so plants that idea in Wilson's mind because Wilson was already suspicious of her having an affair. He kind of gets himself out of any suspicion and gets someone else on Gatsby's back.
Mm-hmm.
And when they arrive back at Gatsby's house, also at Tom's house, Gatsby's like hiding in the bushes, just like he's almost delusional, just like waiting outside to make sure that she's okay, that he doesn't do anything to her, but he's not going to because he barely even cares about her. At this point. And Nick sees him, like, hiding there, but in conversation with him deduces that actually Daisy was the one driving the car, and that Gatsby is just taking the blame for it.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a very confusing sort of little sequence of events here, mm-hmm. but Nick is kind of, the further this goes on, the more Nick is just like, I am over all of this.
Yeah. You kind of said before, though, like, what was the point where Nick should have intervened? And I really, like, did Nick hear Tom tell Wilson that it was Gatsby?
Not in the, well, I don't even know if he does, if he overhears him in the film, actually, because he definitely doesn't overhear him. In the book,
okay,
we get flashed back to that point.
Yeah, okay.
And it's okay, a conversation between.
So if you didn't know that happened, then that's fair. But yeah.
Okay. No, I think he's told this later on, and it flashes back almost in the second to last chapter.
So that he doesn't know that Gatsby's in danger.
No.
Yeah. Okay.
He just thinks that he's like losing the plot.
Yeah.
Gatsby, when he returns home the next day, and he's like cleaning up his car, reveals his entire past to Nick, like who he really was. That, you know, he was only at Oxford for 5 months. That he was a member in the army, and that he thought Daisy would wait for him for 5 years until he got back and had made something of himself. And as he leaves Gatsby to go and swim in his pool, George shows up and shoots Gatsby, thinking that Gatsby was the one who killed Myrtle, and then kills himself as well.
Yeah.
A tragic end to a tragic life, really.
Yep. Can I tell my joke now?
Yes, you can tell your joke.
Megan, who do you think the Great Gatsby's favorite superheroes are?
Who?
Green Lantern and Deadpool.
Oh my god. Oh my god. That's so amazing. No, that is amazing and awful.
It's so good. Yay! I told Adam earlier and he was like, you're going to say that on the podcast, aren't you? And I'm like, yes.
So after Gatsby dies, Nick ends up being the only one at the funeral. The book spends more time on the build-up of this funeral than the film does, and the film like has only reporters showing up, whereas in real life he tries to get Wolfsheim to show up and he doesn't. He tries to get Gatsby's father appears and comes to the funeral. We don't see any of that in the film, and Allies, who's like one of the regular party guests, shows up.
Is he the one that was in the library?
The library. Okay. Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, we didn't really mention him because he just doesn't appear. Well, he's actually listed in the cast, but I assume he's just like a person at the party.
Yeah, I think it makes sense.
Oh, will that be the guy who's like, oh, Gatsby doesn't really exist, and he's the guy up the top of the bookshelf in the library, that's the him. Staircase? That must be him, yeah.
Yeah.
I think in the movie it makes sense because the point of it is that like all these people benefited from knowing Gatsby and going to his parties and they would, like, throw his name around and stuff, but it's, like, this point that, like, at the end of the day, none of them actually cared. And so that's why it's just reporters.
The one thing about the death scene in the movie that is very strange is that the butler is there holding the phone. And I know he's talking to Tobey Maguire's character, but, like, 911 had to be a thing back then, right? Like, you had to have had a way to... If you're going to have the butler there holding the phone, I feel like Gatsby could have lived. At least have the butler, like, come and run over and, like, I don't know, do the whole line on the ground dying where you pan out kind of thing. But it just, like, I rewound it a few times. I was like, does the butler hate him?
I mean, maybe he does.
Yeah.
He might. Like, maybe he treats his staff like total shit. But.
But also, like. He did get shot through the heart. Isn't that, like, a fatal thing? I've never been shot before.
I'm sure it is. And, like, when I rewound it and saw, like, because I missed the actual getting shot the first time. But, like, even still, it's just, you got this butler standing there with the phone just kind of staring. And I was like, okay, either way.
Yeah.
Call an ambulance.
Well, I thought, because I see the butler, like, look at him briefly. But then, like, as we kind of get the shot of Gatsby floating in the pool... Like, there is someone standing over the pool, but I think it's at that point that Nick's narration turns to, like, that, you know, it was only cops and reporters who were there. So I assumed that it was actually a policeman overlooking the pool and not just, like, standing there looking at it.
I hope so.
I don't remember this scene well enough to comment.
And then in the movie, like, Nick finishes his novel, and that's kind of that narrate, and really in the book isn't too much different because he's just finishing narrating his moralistic outlook on all of this. In the book, he does move back to the West, because he's like, the East sucks.
Yeah.
It's basically the gist of it. He's like, oh, you know, people live in these fake lives and all this sort of stuff, and it's just more authentic, I think, back West, he seems to think.
That viewpoint hasn't changed either.
All right. Thumbs up or thumbs down for The Great Gatsby, Lois?
Thumbs up for both. I think there's a reason that The Great Gatsby is studied as a school book, I think, unfortunately.
In America,
yeah. Well, we didn't study it here. No. But we did study some American texts. Like, I did The Crucible in year 11.
Yeah, I think that's more historical than it is. Like, I think because the theme of this, like, you know, one of the regular, I guess, I mean, I've not studied it critically, but one of the focuses of study is how much of this is a representation of the American dream. Yeah. I don't think that's particularly relatable for, like, Australian school kids.
Yeah. But I think there's a reason it's studied also because of, like, the literary ideas that it puts across. And it, also, it is very, a book that it's very transparent in its thoughts. So, and there's a lot you can pull out, so it would be easy to write essays on, you know? But I think everyone should read it, and I think the movie's really good and fun. I've seen it a few times, and I liked it.
Yeah, I think the movie's, like, worth watching for the style alone, almost, like, just the design. It's an incredible-looking film. It's funny, as I was looking at it, I'm like, this is kind of like a weird 3D-esque sort of some of the shots at times, but this was also filmed as a conversion film for 3D, so that's why it might have that appearance sometimes, I think. Yeah, I really enjoyed the movie. I think it's definitely worth watching. I'm kind of torn on the book because I didn't think it's bad enough to not recommend, but I also just didn't really enjoy it. So I guess my thumb's kind of in the middle on this one. I was just kind of, eh.
What did you not enjoy?
I mean, the prose, I guess, like, I found it very thick a lot of the time to get through. I felt like I was just wading through a lot of descriptions of stuff, and that sometimes I just didn't particularly understand what was being said. Maybe that's my comprehension of it. Maybe it's just that it's not particularly a kind of writing style that I like. Maybe it's a combination of both. But I think ultimately, more because I don't think a book gets as critically acclaimed as this is without being, you know, well written. And I'm not saying that it's not well written. I think the biggest reason I didn't enjoy it is it's just not a kind of style of book, or particularly in plot, that I enjoy.
Yeah, I don't think that's true, though. I don't think that there are... I don't think that there aren't books that are badly written but are critically acclaimed.
Well, yeah.
So,
Wuthering Heights.
Yeah, like... We didn't like Wuthering Heights.
Wuthering Heights is, like, one of my best friend's favorite books, and I still can't get through it.
We really struggled.
Yeah.
Because I think, like, often it's not the way it's written. It's not the... I really enjoyed the prose and the dialogue, and I enjoyed reading it. However, I think a lot of the times these classics are classics because of the themes. And, you know, I think Wuthering Heights is particularly a classic because of the, you know, the major heroine in it. And it's written by a woman at a time when women weren't writing books. So there's other reasons these books become classics.
Yeah, like legacy things as well. And the thing is, like, they might have been considered excellent prose and writing, but we're also influenced by, like, you know, compared to Wuthering Heights, we're influenced by, like, a century of texts that have happened since then that build up what we enjoy. And so, they didn't have, you know, that was... cutting edge back then was like
what was I'm really of the opinion that people shouldn't feel bad for not enjoying reading the classics. Like, obviously we read them when we challenge ourselves on this podcast because we are doing the podcast, but I really don't think people should feel like, oh, I have to read all the classics and I have to enjoy all of them, otherwise I'm X. It's like, no, like, some things aren't for you. Like, I really when we've done, like, you know, your more Tom Clancy books, I found them a real slog because it's not what I'm interested in. And those long paragraphs describing cars or guns, I actually have no idea what they're talking about. So I'm like, okay, this is gobbledygook to me.
Field of Dreams.
Yeah, Field of Dreams. I'm like,
I was all about sports.
Yeah, I'm like, a sport book, okay. Like, I just skipping through when they're talking about sport. Okay, plot again, okay, read. Skipping through, talking about sports. Like, you know, it's everyone to their own.
Really. I feel like we're slaying all of Megan's American classics. No. Right in front of her eyes.
Funny enough, so I do have a lit degree. I focused on Gothic literature and Eastern European literature because I hate American literature, like, with a passion, because I don't think it's taught well, and especially in southern states, which I'm from a southern state. And this is probably why, like, this is my first time reading Gatsby. I didn't read it in high school. It, you know, I remember other students reading it, but it was not whatever part of my class. It's funny that you say, like, this can pull from a lot of essays, because it definitely was one of the books that they teach how to write essays from, which I know mine was Catcher in the Rye, because I remember writing my first essay. But yeah, like, I really hate most 1920s literature, which is hilarious because I love the 1920s and I love reading books written in the 1920s, but not, like, from the 1920s. So I have read some Fitzgerald. I'm not a huge fan. I was pleasantly surprised to actually really enjoy this book because it is critically acclaimed, but I also feel like it's just as much hated. Like, it's one of those you kind of begrudgingly read as a teenager. And I think I would have hated it as a teenager. As an adult, I really enjoy it. And I think I get more out of it living in the city, you know, especially in this political climate kind of thing. Like, it's kind of a coming around again, but that I wouldn't have gotten, you know, as a 15-year-old child. So you can hate on as much American literature as you want, because I can join you and tell you all the things that I feel, which is why I did not. I only took one class, and that's because I had to. So, but yeah, I really enjoyed the book. I enjoyed the movie, but there's something about, I don't know, there's not a ton of movies that make me want to sit down and, like, watch them all the way through. Like, I just don't watch a ton of movies unless I'm going to the actual theater nowadays. But I will say this, again, the soundtrack is amazing, and it's one that I listened to for years, long before ever actually watching the movie. So,
what else are we into outside of Great and Lesser Gatsby's?
I can give you another series that's 1920s New York. If it's a supernatural series, it's called The Diviners. It's currently 3 books. The 4th one's being written, but it is a great look at 1920s New York that doesn't whitewash the entire city. It also focuses on the issues that Chinese immigrants were having and the divisions between white and blacks and how big Harlem was and the speakeasies in Harlem versus Lower Manhattan. And all while, like, there's a ghost trying to kill everybody. So, and the 3rd one also focuses on, like, mental institutions in America. So, The Diviner series by Libba Bray.
Cool.
Oh, that's cool. I'm going to look that up. I'm going to recommend a Polygon series called Awful Squad, because that's what I've been doing with my evenings. I haven't actually had a lot of time at home because I've been really busy at work, but when I get home, I've just been chucking on Awful Squad and watching that. It's a series they finished now, but there's loads and loads of episodes of it, and they all go for around an hour or over an hour. And it's basically the Polygon squad, including the McElroy brothers, playing PUBG, which is PlayerUnknown's Battlegrounds, which is just basically, like, 100 people get dropped on an island, they have to find weapons and then kill each other. But, of course, the Polygon team make it really hilarious. They create their own, so there's a custom thing you can do, where you can create a room and then only invite people that you want to invite. And then they create, like, extra goals for themselves. So they, like, add extra challenges. One of them will be asking the others general knowledge questions while they're also trying to fight zombie hordes. So distracting them, basically. So they create like their own games out of it, kind of thing. So it's not just them playing the same game over and over, if that sounds boring. They make it really fun and funny, and they're just basically, all of the videos are just their live streams, so some of them have technical issues and stuff, and it's all left in, they just chuck up the video. But yeah, I'd really recommend that. It's really fun, really funny, and something good to put on, especially if you need to like do work. You can have it on in the background, and you know, just pop your head up and listen to it when it gets like, you know, funny, or when they're in the middle of a game instead of just the setup bits and that kind of thing. So yeah, I really like that.
Sweet. I'm going to throw out something very, very easy, which only was released to the internet last night, which is the new Avengers trailer.
Yeah!
I'm not going to spoil stuff here because you should just go and watch it. It's like 2.5 minutes. If you're not on the Avengers hype train, like, why are you listening to this podcast?
Yeah, why do you listen to our show if you don't like the Avengers?
But, like, the trailer is fantastic. It has some personal moments. It reveals just enough to, like, get you in, but it doesn't reveal anything that will spoil any, like, really any part of this film that you didn't already know as, like, a general internet
dweller. I'm just going to say, I hadn't seen Ant-Man. I had no idea what happens at the end of Ant-Man, so it does spoil that a little bit.
Oh, okay. Well, yeah. Yeah, well, it spoils a couple of other people, I guess, in that regard, but I'm sure they will explain that. But I think, you know, major plot points, and I wouldn't describe Ant-Man maybe as a major plot point, are left untouched.
Yeah, every other Marvel fan's like, it doesn't spoil the movie. And I'm like, but I know who lives through the movie.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, just go flick on the internet, Avengers. And they've given it a title, Endgame.
Yeah.
Which is a pretty... I actually like the version that I clicked on YouTube. It just says Avengers trailer, like, and it's the official Marvel one.
Yeah.
But they didn't give away the title, so yeah, it reveals it in the video itself, which I was like, yes, excellent. Well done.
So I saw it on Facebook. I follow basically the official pages of all the different Avengers, so Thor and everything. I think it was the Thor page I saw had posted it. And they hadn't titled the video, like the title of the video didn't show up, and the only thing they said was the quote from Iron Man that he says right at the start, which is the end of the journey, the end is also a part of the journey, I think is the quote.
Yeah.
And that's just the comment that they put on it. And then I'm
so
really
hyped
excited
for this film. there's a good argument to say this will, regardless of how much money it actually takes in, this is going to be the biggest film of all time.
Yeah. Yeah. Also, I just saw when I was perusing Twitter when I was waiting for Adam to get here, because I made a mistake and got here an hour before I needed to. Black Panther has been nominated for Best Picture for the Academy, which is amazing.
Awesome.
Pushing. Really? Yes, it's been nominated. So that is fantastic.
Was The Dark Knight nominated? That must have been back in the day, surely.
Not for Best Picture,
really?
I don't think. I don't think it was nominated for Best Picture.
Oh, I thought it was, because there was a lot of hype of, was it actually a good picture with Heath Ledger? No,
oh,
wait.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Yeah, that was Dark Knight.
Maybe. But I think that's brilliant. I mean, it's brilliant because it was directed by a person of colour, and it's basically just people of colour in it. But
and
also,
Martin
Freeman and Andy Serkis. But it's also great because it actually is recognizing that sci-fi, fantasy, these big budget films that are made for, that aren't about like war or disability or, you know, all your Oscar grab movies, these big budget films, they mean something, and they are art, and they are telling stories that people want to hear, and it's actually the Academy nodding to that. So I mean, it may not win. I hope it does, but it may not win. And I know there's a whole argument to be had as to whether the Academy is even relevant anymore, because it's basically just run by old white
men. I was about
men.
To say, like, I'm pretty sure most people on the street think the Academy has its head up its arse anyway.
Yeah, it definitely does. But but regardless of whether you think the Academy has its head up its arse, it is still important to films and filmmakers to be nominated. It's like, but it's a catch-22. You don't actually think the Academy really knows what they're talking about, but also getting nominated is a huge deal.
Yep.
So, I'm, yeah, I was really happy to see that.
Yep. All right, next time, we're doing the Polar Express. It's our Christmas special.
Woo! It's going to actually come out on Christmas Day, guys, because the Christmas Day is a Tuesday.
Yeah, boy.
Well, it might come out the 26th, but yeah. We'll see.
It'll be around Christmas time. So it's an illustrated book, I believe, the Polar Express.
Yeah, it's just a picture book.
Yeah, which we're big fans of here. It means minimal reading.
Because we have to do less work.
And around Christmas, that's always a benefit.
Yeah.
You can, of course, find and contact us at wereadthebook@gmail.com, on Twitter at readthebookpod, and on Facebook at the We Read the Book discussion group. We'd love you to join us there.
You can subscribe to us on iTunes and we will appear in your ears. We're also on Stitcher. And thanks to the Dada Weatherman for the use of our theme song, Human Light. And I would like to invite Megan to...
Shamelessly plug everything you do.
Shamelessly plug all the great things that she does now.
Okay. I host 4 podcasts because I'm insane. They are all somehow book tangentially related. I host Judging Book Covers, which is a bi-weekly book club. Fabulous Retellings, which goes through modern fairy tale retellings. Handbook podcast, where we talk about bad books by bad people. And finally, Minds at York, which is our dive into the 1990 series Animorphs.
Yes, Animorphs. So.
I'm yet so good still. Yeah, I'm yet to listen to Minds at York, but I'm like holding off until I like get like down on some of my other podcasts. but I love all your podcasts.
Why? Thank you. Thank you.
And Megan is like the Uber reader. She how many books are you up to now? Over 200 for the year.
I finally added in my Animorphs books because for some reason I didn't want to add them in until I hit 200. Because I'm weird. I have finished 225. I, including books that I did not finish, have done 233 this year.
So nearly a book a day. Like a book. Yeah. A book every
That's more than a book every 2 days.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, add in that like 15 of those are Animorphs because I opened up the last one and then like once I opened it, I couldn't not read it. So. The 14 episodes we've done plus the last book, like those are 150 pages of like size 18 font. But
I know I was thinking about this the other day. It is like it's still impressive when you read loads of books, but I'm reading at the moment a really thick book. Like it's a huge book and I'm like nowhere near my Goodreads goal. And I wish you could also do it by pages or like words.
We ended up doing that 1 year when it was me and my mom and my grandmother because I read a lot smaller books while my mom focuses on much larger books. And I think she technically read more pages than I did.
Yeah.
But yeah, I'm pretty sure I finished like 300 books this year, but I did read every Mr. Men book.
That would be understandable, yes. And that's the other thing is in that 225 does include probably like a good 40 comic trades. So.
Yeah. Oh. Yeah, so it's like, it's not a perfect system, but I still, every time, because we're friends on Goodreads, every time I get on my Goodreads, I'm so ashamed of my number compared to your number, because my number's disgustingly low.
Please don't. Like, it's weird, when I hit 200, I didn't read anything for like a week and a half. I don't know why, like, that was the number after I hit 100, I was like, I want to see if I can do 200, and then it was, like, I exhausted myself somehow, I don't know.
Your girls in your book measuring contests.
Okay, thanks for listening, everyone. I've been Lois Deadpool Mitchell.
I'm Megan Daisy Adair Griffin.
And I am the eyes that are always watching you, Adam Heap.
Bye.
See you later. Yeah, maybe F. Scott Fitzgerald didn't have the balls to write. They were fucking.
And then they're fucked.